From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Another revelation about another CIA torture manual, this one for the Honduran military. We'll speak with the Baltimore Sun reporter who unearthed it. Also, a conversation with conservative Republican Congressmember Frank Wolf. He's just returned from Indonesian-occupied East Timor.
It's kind of like a sign that hangs all over the place. There is fear in this area, and people won't go out at night and are afraid of the military. Perhaps the Clinton administration has a higher obligation than any other because there is a feeling there that the Aleppo connection, the Riadi family and all, has had a major impact on what the policy is of the Clinton administration.
And the road to hell, the ravaging effects of foreign aid and international charity. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Former South African security police officers have confessed to killing leading anti-apartheid activist Steve Biko in 1977. This, according to the country's Truth and Reconciliation Commission today. Their request for amnesty to the commission, which offers a pardon in return for a full confession in the hope of healing the past, was hailed as a breakthrough in clearing up one of apartheid's most notorious crimes. Biko led South Africa's Black Consciousness Movement in the 1970s and died in police detention a month after being arrested in the Eastern Cape city of Port Elizabeth. Dead at the age of 30, he became a martyr for Black South Africans and for anti-apartheid activists around the world. His family has led a campaign against granting of amnesty for Steve Biko's killers. Following the lead of 19 other states, New York State has announced it is suing the tobacco industry to recover the billions of dollars spent on health care for smoking-related illnesses. Among those corporations that are being sued, R.J. Reynolds, Philip Morris, Brown & Williamson, and Lowe's Corporation's Lorillard Tobacco. Chechens voted in presidential and parliamentary elections overwhelmingly dominated by candidates promising independence from Russia. Last year's truce ending a vicious 21-month war with Moscow's forces called for putting the sovereignty issue aside for 5 years, but that appears to be going unheeded. Heavy turnout was reported. More than 100,000 Serbs marched through Belgrade in a procession led by the Serbian Orthodox Patriarch. Riot police, in contrast with their recent confrontational tactics, quietly withdrew. The highly visible support by the church gave a boost to protesters demanding restoration of opposition victories in recent municipal elections. Hospital patients have expressed great dissatisfaction with their care. In a survey of nearly 37,000, many complained of being sent home too early, that care was impersonal, and that insurers call the shots. The American Hospital Association, whose members often are at odds with insurers over costs, was the survey's sponsor. The FBI has suspended a crime laboratory supervisor who in 1995 alleged that pro-prosecution bias and mishandling of evidence may have tainted testimony in several big cases, including the World Trade Center and the Oklahoma City bombings. Senator Grassley said the move appears to be a reprisal. And Switzerland's U.S. ambassador quit amid mounting criticism of a memo he wrote recommending waging war against Jewish groups seeking answers about Holocaust victims' bank accounts and Switzerland's wartime relations with the Nazis. Parts of the memo were leaked over the weekend. In San Francisco, owning videotapes of Bull Durham or Dirty Dancing could land someone in prison because of a new law aimed at child pornography. This, according to a free speech group that sued the federal government. The law is so badly written that it converts hundreds of mainstream movies into child pornography, so says Jeffrey Douglas, a criminal defense lawyer and chair of the Los Angeles-based Free Speech Coalition. Yesterday, the group asked for a federal injunction against enforcing parts of the law which make it illegal to film adults pretending to be minors depicting sexual intimacy on film. An Oregon jail violated the country's longstanding respect for religious confessions when it taped a talk between a priest and an inmate suspected of three slayings. This, according to a federal appeals court. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled yesterday that Oregon can no longer tape such conversations, saying that the practice violates federal law and the U.S. Constitution. Judge John Noonan wrote in a 3-0 decision, "A priest has the right to rely on the nation's history of respect for religion in general, and respect for the sanctity of the secrets of confession in particular. And American Express is laying off 3,300 workers, most based overseas, in an effort to improve its travel services unit, they say. The company announced the move yesterday as it reported a 55% increase in fourth quarter profits compared with a year earlier. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Nearly 2 years ago, the Baltimore Sun broke a major story detailing how a CIA-trained Honduran Army unit known as Battalion 316 kidnapped, tortured, and murdered Honduran political opponents with the full knowledge and complicity of U.S. officials. At the time, the Honduran revelations came on the heels of a number of other sensational exposés about CIA relations with death squads in the Caribbean and Latin America, including CIA relations with the notorious FRAP death squad in Haiti and with the Guatemalan military. Yesterday, journalists with the Baltimore Sun published another article on CIA activity in Honduras during the 1980s, namely how the CIA taught torture techniques to the Honduran military. Joining us now from Baltimore is Gary Cohen, a Baltimore Sun reporter who co-authored yesterday's story about the CIA torture manual. He also broke the 1995 story on the CIA-trained Battalion 316 and the kidnapping, tortures, and murders sponsored by the CIA unit during the 1980s. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Gary.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for inviting me on. I have great respect for the work you do on this show.
Well, thank you. Well, why don't you tell us about this story that you broke yesterday based on some documents you got under the Freedom of Information Act?
This story grew out of our earlier investigation into Battalion 316. In the course of researching the role of the CIA in training Honduran military officials in the 1980s, we learned that there were a series of training manuals, and we requested these manuals from the CIA in May of 1994. And the CIA has been basically stonewalling for the last couple of years. We hired a law firm, and we threatened to file a lawsuit against the CIA if they didn't produce the manuals by last Friday. And at that point, they did turn over the manuals. And the manuals confirm what we have long suspected, that basically the torture was taught by the CIA to military officials in Honduras and elsewhere in Latin America. This manual is very, very disturbing. As an American, I'm disturbed by this because I really think our CIA and our government should stand for something else. The techniques in the manual are torture techniques, and they are unmistakably similar to the methods that members of Battalion 316 they used on their captives in the 1980s.
Let's talk about the cover sheet that was placed in the manual in March of 1985. Which cautions the use of force, mental torture, threats, insults, or exposure to inhumane treatment of any kind as an aid to interrogation is prohibited by law. Both international and domestic, it is neither authorized nor condoned. How does that fit in with the manual?
Well, I'm a little bit puzzled by that. On the one hand, the CIA says that this is prohibited and we don't want you to do it. On the other hand, they say, but here are the things that are prohibited and we want you to know about it. Rather than tell you what I think, I'd like to quote you something from Defense Secretary William Cohen. This came up at a closed hearing of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence in June 1988. And at the time, Senator Cohen was a member of the Intelligence Committee. And this is what he said. Number one, I am not sure why in 1983 it became necessary to have such a manual. But number two, upon its discovery, why we only sought to revise it in a fashion which says, these are some of the techniques we think are abhorrent. We just want you to be aware of them so you avoid them. There's a lot in this that troubles me in terms of whether you were sending subliminal signals that say, this is improper, but by the way, you ought to be aware of it. I think that Senator Cohen has said it very, very well there. I think he was disturbed by it. I think he saw through this exactly what the CIA was doing. And furthermore, members of Battalion 316, the stories they tell are consistent, that they sure, they heard this, but they also said that they that their leaders insisted on torture.
You talk about the manual suggesting that prisoners be deprived of food and sleep, maintain rigid positions such as standing at attention for long periods of time, putting things in the room that the prisoner might be afraid of. For example, if a person doesn't like cockroaches, make sure that they're running around the room.
That's right. And that's those techniques sound bad enough in, when you sort of see them on the page in black and white. When you hear that those techniques described by former victims of Battalion 316, you realize just how brutal those techniques are. My colleague Ginger Thompson interviewed a woman named Inez Murillo, who was held captive by the Hondurans for 78 days in 1983. By the way, the same year that the manual was put together. And she describes treatment that is extremely similar to theirs. She was given no food or water for days to keep her from sleeping. One of her captors entered her room every 10 minutes and poured water over her head. She was there was a dog brought in, and she was forced to stand immobile. She was told that if she moved, the dog would attack her. These are very, very similar, or really the same techniques that are advocated in the manual.
And who was Inez? Why was she picked up?
Inez Murillo was a leftist, a dissident. By some accounts, she may have been a subversive. There are conflicting stories. She may or may not have been involved in illegal activities. In any event, if she was, I think the more proper thing would have been to arrest her and put her on trial. If she was innocent, let her go. If she was guilty, hold her in prison or punish her in another way. That was humane. Not pick her up and hold her in secret jails and torture her for 78 days.
We're talking to Gary Cohen, who is a Baltimore Sun reporter, who, along with two other reporters, published a piece yesterday in the newspaper about newly declassified CIA training manuals, which detail torture methods. And it's believed they were used in the 1980s by a notorious battalion in Honduras known as Battalion 316. Can you talk a little about Florencio Caballero, former member of Battalion 316?
Yes, he was a former member of Battalion 316. He was a interrogator and a torturer. We held extensive on-the-record interviews with Caballero in Toronto, where he's living, and he detailed the way that the battalion stalked, kidnapped, and in some cases tortured and executed prisoners. The stories he told to us were very, very consistent with the stories testimony he gave to human rights investigators in a OAS court in Costa Rica, and with testimony which he gave to the staff of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, which we've 10 copies of. And he detailed his training by the CIA, both in Honduras. He also says that he was trained, but brought to a base in the United States and trained by the CIA. He says that that his CIA instructors discouraged physical torture, but taught him methods of psychological torture. And as one example, he said that find out what a person likes and dislikes, and then use that against them. For example, if a person does not like cockroaches, then that person might be more cooperative if there were cockroaches running around the room, and other methods of psychological torture.
Hmm. Now, what has Honduras been able to get from the Clinton administration around these manuals? Did Honduras have these manuals before you were able to get them under the Freedom of Information Act?
No, Honduras does not have these manuals. Honduras has not been given any information by the CIA. Basically, the CIA has been stonewalling the Hondurans. The State Department has turned over, I believe, about 2,000 pages of documents, both to the Hondurans and to us. But the CIA has so far not turned over any information.
And what extent has Honduras, the government of Honduras, gone to get this information from the CIA?
The government of Honduras and the Honduran Human Rights Commissioner, a very brave man named Leo Valladares, have been seeking this information for at least 2 years and probably 3 years.
And what have been the grounds that the U.S. government has withheld them, aside from being the number one superpower in the world?
Well, basically the government has made a lot of, and the Clinton administration has made a lot of promises to the Hondurans, and certain agencies such as the State Department have made good, belatedly, but they have made good on providing that information. Basically, the CIA has not turned over anything and has, in a word, stonewalled.
You also, in your article yesterday on Battalion 316, you also got a Vietnam-era training manual called KUBARC, Counterintelligence Interrogation, July 1963. Can you talk about that?
Right. This is a manual which we believe was the basis for the lessons that were taught in Honduras and the basis for the 1983 manual. The manuals are very similar, and we have been told that that much of the training in Honduras and notes that were taken of instruction given in Honduras are very similar, in a lot of cases almost word for word, with the lessons taught in the 63 KUBARC manual. And one of the most interesting sections of this manual there are two references, one direct and one oblique reference to electric shock. The introduction to this manual warns that approval from headquarters is required if the interrogation is to include bodily harm or if, quote, medical, chemical, or electrical methods or materials are to be used to induce acquiescence. And another passage on preparing for an interrogation contains this advice. If a new safe house is to be used as the interrogation site, it should be studied carefully to be sure that the total environment can be manipulated as desired. For example, the electric current should be known in advance so that the transformers or other modifying devices will be on hand if needed. And an intelligence source told us that, quote, the CIA has acknowledged privately and informally in the past that this referred to the application of electric shocks to interrogation suspects. I should add that we interviewed 14 members of Battalion 316 during our investigation, and 9 of those people told us that they were subjected to electric shocks.
What laws are broken here? I mean, we have to assume that there are some laws broken here.
I'm not totally familiar with exactly what the law is now or was at the time. The manual itself implies that many of these and the rewritten part of the manual implies that many of these techniques were both improper and illegal.
You know, you have to wonder, at the top of the little newscast I did at the top of the show, we talked about South Africa and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and those that were possibly responsible for the murder, or those that are responsible for the murder of Steve Biko. If there should be such a commission set up here in this country that looks at all of this kind of documentation and holds people responsible.
I think that's needed. I mean, right, the CIA has been conducting an internal review that started about 1 week after our June 1995 series. But so far, nothing has been released from that. The CIA claims that they are still reviewing the record to find out what happened there. But I think you're right. I think that an outside independent review is certainly called for.
You know, in this time of media monopolies, we don't see a lot of investigative reporting. You did this piece yesterday. A year ago, you came out with your four-part series on what's been going on in Honduras, on kidnapping and tortures and murder. And you worked on that story for more than a year. How is it that your editors are allowing you to do this?
Well, our editors have been just great at that. They have been behind this all the time. They've had the the vision to see this as an important story, and they've given us the time, they've given us the resources, they've allowed us to travel. We've spent money to hire an excellent law firm, which helped us get documents from the State Department, and most recently from the CIA. I'm convinced that the reason that the CIA turned over the manual is only because they realized that we were going to file suit and that our lawyers were not joking. We actually sent them a draft of the lawsuit we were preparing to file, and we were prepared to file. So our editors believe in this kind of journalism, and you're right. In these days, we're very lucky to work at a place that gives us the time and the support.
Well, Gary Cohen, I want to thank you very much for joining us from Baltimore. Gary Cohen, a Baltimore Sun reporter, whose piece came out yesterday in the Baltimore Sun. Do you know the website by any chance where the Baltimore Sun can be found?
I don't. I should know it, but I can. I can give you a call later and let you know.
Okay. People can put Baltimore Sun in their search engine, and you'll find this article as well as others. Thank you very much for joining us.
One other thing, we do have reprints of the original series, and if people are interested, they can call me directly, and I'll be happy to send them out.
What is your number?
Phone number is 410-332-6152.
That's 410-332-6152. Thanks very much for being with us, Gary.
Thank you.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Coming up in our last segment, The Road to Hell, the Ravaging Effects of Foreign Aid and International Charity. But first this. As more and more information surfaces on President Clinton's fundraising ties to wealthy Indonesian families close to the Indonesian dictator General Suharto, some congressional legislators are now saying that President Clinton must show real independence from Indonesian moneyed interests by taking a leadership role in serving as a mediator to end the 21-year Indonesian occupation of East Timor. One such lawmaker is Congressmember Frank Wolf. He's a conservative Republican from Northern Virginia, and he's just returned from a trip to East Timor. He's one of the few Congress members who's gone to Indonesia, East Timor, not on an Indonesian junket, like people like Clinton Deputy Attorney General Webster Hubble, who, after he was forced out of the Justice Department, was hired by the Lippo Group to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars, and he was sent to East Timor. Well, Frank Wolf joins us now, and I want to start by asking you about your trip to East Timor and what you found there.
We got there. Spent 2 nights and 3 days, met with Bishop Bella, met with the officials, the government officials, broke away from them and went off, and we went through the Santa Cruz Cemetery. We walked through the village, walked through the different parts of the town. And frankly, what we found was total and complete fear. Things had relaxed quite a bit and then got bad again on December 24th when Bishop Bella returned from getting the Nobel Peace Prize. There was a soldier killed who apparently was in civilian clothing taking pictures of them, and I think perhaps the crowd turned on them. But they have gone through homes, coming in at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, knocking on the doors, frightening the people, then in many cases taking young people, 18 to 25 to 30, away. There were 15 to 22 that had been arrested. People were saying that their workers were coming in the next day, were totally tired because they were just literally sitting up waiting for the knock on the door. It was parallel to what we saw in Romania in 1985, very tense, very fearful, people not wanting to talk to you when the government people were with us, which was most of the time. People just didn't want to say. If we broke away, then they would talk to us quietly. But even people who we were talking to outside of this area, talking about other issues, as we began to talk about this, their voice would drop very, very low. Almost nobody around listening, but for fear that maybe somebody was. So the island's tense. It's dangerous. No one goes out past dark. Was it that way when you were there? Is darkness the time?
Absolutely. It's an unspoken curfew. In fact, Indonesian military would wear black, cover their faces, and they call them the ninjas, and they would go out at night.
They referred to the ninjas quite a bit there, and they also have apparently paid money to some East Timorese who are informing on the others from East Timor. And the ninja issue came up over and over. But no one goes out after dark, and there's a lot of fear. And the inference was from people that talked to us that the tension is beginning to equate to how it was around the Santa Cruz massacre. And if something isn't done to diffuse that issue, one never knows, but could it break out? Secondly, the people are very proud of Bishop Bella winning the Nobel Peace Prize. There was a large banner across the main road welcoming him home. His name comes up over and over and over. Thirdly, we made a whole series of recommendations. One, that our government, the United States government, begin to focus on this issue. Perhaps the Clinton administration has a higher obligation than any other because there is the feeling there that the Lippo connection, the Riady family and all, has had a major impact on what the policy is of the Clinton administration. Now, I don't know if it has or it hasn't, but there's certainly the presumption there that it has. And so we recommend a whole series of things. More NGOs to go to the island. As you know, they're prohibited from going. More press be able to go. As you know, the press is prohibited from going except for Bishop Bella's return and this dedication of the statue out on the end of the island, the statue of Christ. Some events like that, they're allowed in, but generally not. Then we also recommended that the army be drawn down. But the main recommendation is that the United States uses good offices, which it has a lot of them, with the Indonesian government, and perhaps develop a panel whereby the United States, in cooperation with Indonesia, with Germany, who has a very close relationship with Indonesia, with the Portuguese, who you would have to involve, and lastly, with people from East Timor, develop a process which would lead to what, we're not sure, because that's not for me to say, but would lead to something else other than what you have there. It could be anywhere from total independence, or it could be from whereby you still play the Indonesian national anthem and you still have the Indonesian flag, but the local autonomy is done by the people from East Timor. But I think that would be for these people to make this decision on what. But I think the bottom line is the United States government really has an obligation, almost a duty now, particularly with the F-16 issue and expanded IMET and some of the relationships that we have, to work with the Indonesians to bring something about whereby the process begins to develop, whereby they can deal with these issues. Otherwise, I think you potentially are going to have something that blows up again and maybe a lot more people killed.
House Speaker Newt Gingrich said before the election, all weapons flows, like the F-16 sales, like the military training aid that President Clinton is pushing, both the military training aid and the F-16s, should be put on hold until there are full hearings into the U.S. relationship with Indonesia. Do you agree with that?
Well, I do agree with that. I have really avoided getting too specific with regard to the F-16. Obviously, I would oppose the F-16s, but I don't know that we should go and make that the issue going in. I think it's more important to begin the talks. It's more important for the United States to use its effectiveness to bring about a process whereby all these issues can be looked at. if that were done, you know, then if the F-16s are sold at some date, you know, who knows? I mean, if you're working toward autonomy, whereby the people of East Timor are going to have their freedom, then do the F-16s make that much of a difference? Who knows? So I have avoided, although I have personal opinions, I've avoided dealing with those issues with the hope that we can convince Mrs. Albright to begin to put this on the front burner. And we have attempted to make it, not to embarrass the Clinton administration, but to make it clear they really do have an obligation, because the people out there, as well as people here, believe that the RIADI, the LiPo, the contributions have had an impact on the issue of East Timor. My sense is they have also had a major impact on the issue of China. Here you have the situation, no connection with regard to human rights. This guy Wang gets to the White House, who was head of the Poly Corporation, which was selling assault weapons to street gangs in California. And Harry Wu, who's an American citizen who was arrested by the Chinese, and his wife, Mrs. Wu, could not even get in to see the president. And now you have Poly Corporation's president, who's been involved in activities that are against the law, getting in to have coffee with the president. So there's a craziness here that doesn't make any sense. But we're trying to develop the approach that Mrs. Albright and this administration ought to take this issue up and take it up quickly. I mean, they don't have a lot of time. My goal was, for the next 2 or 3 weeks, is to get the United States government engaged, to get them active. We also made a recommendation that a high-level official, I used Colin Powell's name, but I don't think he would be interested in doing it, somebody who either used to be an ambassador or a military person, retired military from our country, go over there as an emissary, working with Ambassador Stapleton Roy, to do something. The number one goal I have is to get this administration obligated, which I believe they are morally obligated. And if they don't do anything and something happens there, I think, frankly, the responsibility will be with this administration. I mean, this RIADI thing is corrupt. The John Wang thing is corrupt. The LiPo thing appears to be corrupt. And so, therefore, they have a greater obligation. So my goal is not to get a story, not to do anything, not to be confrontational, but to get the administration to engage the Indonesians quickly.
Have you had any sign from the administration since you've returned and held your news conference in the House Radio TV Gallery? Any response?
I have, and I've spoken to people in the White House about this issue. I furnished them with tapes that I've taken. We took a video camera there, and also with my report, and so we have been in touch with them, yes, and they have been in touch back.
And what are they saying? What's their response to your call for U.S. mediation?
You know, I don't have any comment about that. We would just have to wait and see.
Congressman Wolf, why are you so interested in East Timor?
I'm interested because a couple of reasons. One, Congressman Hall, Tony Hall, who's a good friend of mine, Tony nominated Bishop Bella, and I second Bishop Bella's nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize. We were in Oslo together to see Bishop Bella receive it. I followed this issue for a number of years, and having seen this and having gone out there directly, as you know, and of course spending two nights and three days, or it doesn't make you an expert, but I wanted to see firsthand all that I'd read about and heard about, and for that reason is how I got interested in it.
Do you think we'll see progress on East Timor in this administration in this next year? You're talking actually about just a few weeks.
I hope so, and if we don't, the administration is going to hear about it, because I'm going to continue to talk about it over and over and over. And at a certain point, if there's no progress, we'll continue to ratchet up the conversations about it, but I'm hopeful. I hope so.
I know that you took videotape at the Santa Cruz Cemetery. What did you find when you went there?
We found there and everywhere else fear and terror.
Fear and terror, you said?
Right. Fear of the military, and the people are in terror.
When you talked to Timorese, had they heard anything of the RIADI scandal of Indogate here?
Some had. They get CNN. They get television news. The world's very, very small, although it's far away, but it's still very, very small. Yes, they have heard.
The Senate is going to hold hearings into Clinton and the campaign finances, and they will deal with the whole issue of Indogate.
Yeah.
Will the House hold hearings into the administration?
I think the House will hold hearings. Congressman Chairman Burton will be holding hearings on that issue.
Looking at the U.S. administration's relationship with Indonesia?
I believe so, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for spending
nice
this time.
Congressmember Frank Wolf, a conservative Republican from Northern Virginia. He's just returned from East Timor, where over the last 21 years, more than 200,000 Timorese have been killed by the Indonesian military.
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No politician bent enough.
To bury your story. To keep it from us. Love from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
No blackout dark
enough.
No business deal big enough. No heart hollow.
No grave wide enough.
To bury your story. To keep it from us. Love from a short distance.
Love from a Short Distance is a compilation CD for the children of East Timor. And as we reported a few days ago in the January 17th issue of the Washington Post, they reported that Stanley Roth is the most likely candidate for the post of Assistant Secretary of State, replacing Winston Lord. And we got a action alert from the East Timor Action Network, ETAN, which has declared its opposition to his possible appointment. They say that Stanley Roth has been one of Suharto regime's strongest supporters in Washington and would further weaken the Clinton administration's already tepid policy towards East Timor. And they give the number of the White House hotline, as the White House is in the midst of determining the high-level officers now of the State Department. And that number is 202-456-1111. That's 202-456-1111. Also, when we play the East Timor documentary, Massacre, the Story of East Timor, on Human Rights Day, the day that Bishop Bello and José Ramos Horta received the Nobel Peace Prize to East Timorese, we got lots of calls of people who wanted more information on East Timor. The phone number of the East Timor Action Network is 914-428-7299. That's 914-428-7299 to find out about action alerts and legislation that's before Congress and other issues. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we move now to another international issue, an issue around foreign aid and humanitarian aid. Humanitarian military interventions, as they've been known, have grown rapidly since the end of the Cold War. Whether in Haiti, Somalia, Liberia, or more recently in Bosnia and Rwanda, the images of starving children or entire communities held hostage to corrupt military gangs are increasingly being used to justify U.S. or U.N. military adventures. At the same time, the humanitarian aid business has never received as much attention and money. But whose interests do agencies like CARE, Feed the Children, and Catholic Relief Services really serve? And are humanitarian interventions a mask for a new type of colonialism? Joining us to talk about this issue is Michael Marin. He's formerly an aid worker in Somalia, more recently a journalist and author, and he's just published a new book called The Road to Hell, The Ravaging Effects of Foreign Aid and International Charity. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael.
Morning, Amy.
Well, before we break, if you can give us just a thumbnail sketch of the main thesis of your book, Road to Hell.
The main thesis, if I could boil it down quickly, is there is no such thing as a purely humanitarian intervention. I think people try to say, we're not involved politically, this is just humanitarian, we just want to save children. If you intervene in a situation, you are getting involved politically. You can't avoid the politics, and you always have to ask the question, who is this intervention helping? Who are the beneficiaries of this? And the answers are usually not the children. It's usually not the people who you think you're intervening to help.
Well, when we come back from our break, we're going to ask you about your experience in Catholic Relief Services and then talk about these other humanitarian groups and particularly your work in Africa. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm Amy Goodman, and this is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Our guest is Michael Marin. Michael Marin is a reporter, has reported for The Village Voice, New Republic, Harper's, and has a long-time experience in Africa. He was in the Peace Corps for 2 years in Kenya. He worked for the Catholic Relief Services in Kenya and the Sudan, and actually worked for USAID, USAID, the Agency for International Development, for a year in Somalia. Well, tell us specifically now about the various, what we call, humanitarian groups, and give us case studies of how you think they have served other than a simply humanitarian purpose.
If you look at the finances of any one of these groups, what you quickly realize is we tend to think that the money they get, the money they spend, is the money that's donated by school children or the money they raise off their advertisements on television. The reality is that most of them get most of their money from the U.S. government. Most of them are, in fact, U.S. government contractors doing the bidding of the State Department through the Agency for International Development to pursue projects that are that agree with the policies of the U.S. government. The book outlines, using stories and anecdotes, the U.S. involvement in Somalia during the 1980s. I think most people only became aware of Somalia when we intervened in 1992.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the history of Somalia.
Somalia was a country that in the 1970s was a Soviet client. They were completely a Soviet client state. In the late 70s, they switched over to the U.S. about the same time they invaded Ethiopia. And the Ethiopia invasion caused an influx of refugees from Ethiopia into Somalia. The Somali government decided to use those refugees for its own political purposes. They used the refugees who were from the president's clan to displace people from other clans. And that began the sort of social unraveling that resulted in the famine and the disaster in 1990 through 1992. What they did was they used aid organizations, and the organization predominantly involved at this time was CARE. CARE set up refugee camps. They fed those refugees for 15 years while they were being used to, the refugee camps that CARE was running were being used as guerrilla bases and as army recruiting centers for the dictatorship of Siad Barre, the dictator in Somalia.
Who was supported by the United States.
Who was backed by the U.S. because at the time the U.S. considered Somalia in a very strategic location. It was also bordering against the Soviet-backed regime in Ethiopia. So the U.S. government's decision to back the Siad Barre regime translated into CARE doing a project that also supported U.S. government goals there. In the book, I investigated, I asked the question somewhat rhetorically, why would CARE support a project year after year after year that was clearly hurting people? There was a lot of evidence that these projects were hurting people. And the answer was that they had about an $8 million annual contract with the U.S. government to do that. And that paid them $1 million in salaries for their people and was a substantial part of their income.
What has been the response of CARE to your analysis?
Most of the NGOs have chosen to ignore me. I think part of their strategy is if they raise the issues, they're not going to win. They're not going to win because the book is full of documents and things that show exactly what did happen. Save the Children is another one. Their response all along has been, let's ignore this and hope it goes away.
You draw a very vivid picture of a plane landing, a plane of one of the humanitarian groups coming into land, but waiting for a while before cameras are set up so that they can come in competition for the international aid dollars.
Well, that's the other side of the business. It is a very, very competitive business, and the only way to really regard the aid organizations is not as charities but as businesses that are competing for limited funds from governments and limited funds from donors. So they fight with each other like crazy for press attention and that sort of thing. So they will do things such as they will delay delivering food if the cameras aren't set up.
And give us an example of that.
Well, there's a part in the book where they make the plane circled around the one runway, the airfield three or four times, and then taxied very slowly so that all the journalists could get the shots of it. It's not only airplanes. I've seen it happen in where they'll delay in the early part of the Somalia intervention. They waited to send food out until all the journalists got there, and of course all the aid organizations have their flags flying on the fronts of their trucks. And probably the most egregious example of this was in Goma, Zaire, in the summer of 1994, when hundreds of thousands of refugees fled from Rwanda into Zaire. And if you went to these refugee camps, it looked like a trade show. I mean, it was like walking into the Javits Center when there's a bunch of companies competing for your attention, because you had all of these organizations, and there were big banners for CARE and Save the Children, and the ones you know, as well as hundreds of other aid organizations that you have never heard of. And they're all passing out baseball caps and T-shirts and waving their banners and setting up their little tents. And it appeared to me that they were putting more energy into promoting themselves than into actually doing any charitable work.
I know in Haiti, in the 1980s, the burning of the warehouses that were filled with wheat that were brought in by CARE. And people in the United States thought that this was a very ungrateful act. Here you had this humanitarian aid organization bringing food, and the Haitians themselves would burn it. And instead of showing the sophisticated political analysis that Haitians had of what CARE was doing, one of the things was wiping out local farmers, which ultimately would lead to buying food from the United States when you first bring in free food. They showed them as ungrateful and ignorant.
Well, ungrateful and ignorant, those are the two key words. And if you look at, say, advertisements for some of these agencies, I think one of the things they do is, CARE does this, and Save the Children probably worse than most, these people are helpless. These people are so ignorant that, you know, a 22-year-old American volunteer can walk into a village in Africa or in Haiti and have something valuable to teach, let's say, a 50-year-old farmer. And the concept in itself is ridiculous, but they hammer that home again and again. And when people reject the aid, which they often do because they realize how it's tearing their societies apart, they are then portrayed as ungrateful, and that's what happened in Somalia as well. I mean, these ungrateful people are stealing all the food that is going in there. What the people realize is, and there was a case in Somalia where they actually had a very good harvest that year, the year of the American intervention. And the farmers who had grown all of this food had let the stuff rot because they couldn't sell their food. They couldn't get their investment back because there was so much free food around. People were drowning in this stuff.
We're talking to Michael Marin. His book is called The Road to Hell, The Ravaging Effects of Foreign Aid and International Charity. He's a person who knows well what he's talking about, having spent much of the last 20 years in Africa, first as an aid worker and later as a journalist. What about Rwanda? You talk in your book about Americans for African Adoptions International. You talk about CARE. You talk about the Red Cross and the United Nations.
The Rwanda situation was what happened. Let me back up just a little bit. All these agencies were in Somalia for a while. And then this tragedy struck in Rwanda. A plane was shot down. Some 700,000 to a million people were slaughtered in what is probably the worst concentrated massacre in human history. There's no way to gauge it, but that seems certain. All this press attention went into Rwanda, and therefore all of the money went into Rwanda, and therefore all of the aid agencies went into Rwanda and into Zaire, because the refugees began fleeing out of Rwanda. Refugees, incidentally, who were not the victims of the slaughter. What this was, and if you put the economic analysis onto these charities, was this was a growth opportunity for a charity. There was money there. Therefore, they ran in. The Americans for African Adoptions was a perfect example. These people went in there and started scooping up orphans.
Who are they?
They were some fly-by-night group that came out of, I believe, the Midwest somewhere. I don't remember offhand. You and I, if we felt like it, let's say there was some horrible tragedy somewhere, any two or three people can get together, form an NGO, form a relief agency, start raising money and going in there and doing work, taking babies, if we wanted to take babies out, because there was no authority. You know, you don't have to have a license to drive a taxi cab in New York City, but anybody can go in there and do development work, because we have this idea that because we're Americans, because we live in this great land of plenty, and the subliminal part is might be because we're white, which we have something, we can help these people, we can go in there, and even if we don't know anything in particular. Any bit of charity, any, you know, sort of cast off old clothes, any or a few little dimes are going to help them, and that's simply not true. I think these aid agencies, some of the small ones like the Americans for African Adoptions, and to the big ones like CARE with their $500 million budgets, continually pound home the idea to us that. We can help. These people are completely—they're stupid. They really need us. If I learned one thing in Africa over the years is that people are very resourceful. For the most part, they're extremely capable of taking care of themselves. But I think through the NGOs, ads, and through the press, and I should mention this, we continue to get the idea of Africa as this backward, very helpless place. And one of the reasons for this is that when journalists go into Africa, they go into, you know, they might go to Mozambique or Zaire or something like that. Foreign journalists, the first people they're going to seek out are other foreigners who are living in the villages. The first people they go to for information, they go to get what they think is the real story, is they go to aid workers. I'm not saying that the aid workers are evil people, but aid workers tend to see Africans not from the perspective of what these people can do, but from a perspective of what they can't do, how they need us. And I think that view of Africa as this backward, helpless place just permeates our thinking about the continent. People are always saying to me, they come up to me and say, you know, I've read your book, and, well, what are you saying, that we should let people die and starve to death? And I have to stop and I say, where did you get the idea that if a bunch of American kids pulled out of Africa, the whole continent would starve to death? They were taking care of themselves for forever before we got there. And the aid business is going on for about 30 years, 30 years during which things are a lot worse than they were before.
So would you make the argument that in place most recently in Zaire and Rwanda, that they would be better off if there was just no intervention at all?
I think many times they would have been better off without an intervention. I show in my book that the Somalia intervention, that great heralded gesture by George Bush, was absolutely unnecessary. The famine was over by the time we intervened. The Somalia intervention was not about saving lives. The Somalia intervention was about building an international peacekeeping force. Somalia was a testing ground. It was an experiment to build a structure that could then be used in Bosnia or in other places. It failed, which is why the UN did not go and intervene militarily in Bosnia. The Rwanda situation, I think the case can be made, and it's very hard to come up with hard scientific data on any of this, but as many people probably died fleeing Rwanda to get to the NGOs as would have died if they had stayed there to begin with. I think the NGOs, to a certain extent, are responsible for the refugee exodus and therefore for the deaths of people.
Madeleine Albright, the new Secretary of State, how do you see her direction in foreign policy? In fact, it seems that she tends a little away from peacekeepers and more toward military intervention, full-scale soldiers moving in.
Well, I agree. That's I think what we're going to get. We're going to get quite a bit of that, and you have to see all of this intervention as a marketplace, as a competition for the aid dollar. And suddenly I have a chapter in my book called Merchants of Peace, in which that's set in a trade show. It used to be called an arms bazaar, and now it was called a peacekeeping bazaar. Peacekeeping and humanitarianism are the new wars. We're going to have a war on hunger, all right? So the military the guys in the military are all jazzed about this. Then NATO is thrilled. I mean, NATO, an organization that really has no reason whatsoever to exist right now, now sees themselves as a humanitarian intervention force. All of this is about is keeping people in their jobs. Military leaders, people who are working for charities who are making high six-figure salaries, and a lot of other people without who wouldn't have anything to do if it wasn't for all of this humanitarian aid. There's a chapter in my book called Pigs at the Trough, and it describes the aid agencies and agricultural companies. The biggest beneficiaries until now of foreign aid have been large agricultural trading companies, and I'm talking Archer Daniels, Midland, Continental, the Bunge Corporation, many of them privately held companies that have shipped all of this food overseas. But what it is it's a lot of people lined up to get a big chunk of public money. The reality is that most of that money comes right back to us. Most of that money, what we call aid money, is paid in salaries to executives and are paid to think tanks and that sort of thing.
When I was in Haiti, I talked to a U.S. Agency for International Development official, and he very proudly boasted that most of the money that comes here, I think it's 70 or 80% of the money that went to Haiti, would go back to the United States in the form of contracts, in the form of paying contractors to come from the United States.
A former ambassador to Somalia, when I was interviewing him in Nairobi, said it very concisely. He said, aid is a supply-driven business. We give them what we have to get rid of, not what they need. If a farmer in Ethiopia really needs an ox, he's not going to get an ox because we don't have a big ox company here in America that's going to supply it. He'll get a John Deere or a Ford tractor or something like that because aid becomes a subsidy for these corporations. And so his tractor gets sent over there, and then the tractor becomes not a help to him, but it becomes a burden because all of a sudden you need spare parts and gasoline and a lot of other stuff that's very expensive and hard to get.
Well, Michael Marin, I want to thank you very much for joining us. It is a very interesting book that you have just written and published. It is called The Road to Hell, The Ravaging Effects of Foreign Aid and International Charity. Michael Marin is its author, and this book is published by the Free Press. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. Our executive producer is Julie Drizin. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And let me let you know what's coming up in the next few days, actually. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about biotechnology. You'll be hearing from Indian activist Vandana Shiva. On Thursday, it's breast cancer. We'll be taking a look at poisons and politics. And on Friday, we're going to be going back to someone we took up on Democracy Now! A few weeks ago, and that is Yip Harburg. Yip Harburg, who wrote Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?, The Wizard of Oz, and Finian's Rainbow. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks very much for joining us for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
9:15. Universal time, 14:59, 20 seconds. U.S. Naval Observatory, Mass.